welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Saturday, May 16th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. Meat industry butchered by COVID-19 in the Midwest. It's a living, breathing bottleneck of livestock choking the Midwest's meat industry. The food is there, but frustratingly out of reach in some cases, as COVID-19 has closed or slowed production at Midwest meat processing plants, confounding farmers, retail operators, and consumers. A traffic jam of livestock is stalled on farms and ranches as major processing plants spanning Wisconsin, Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, and Indiana struggle to react to the impact of the virus on its workforce. As farmers are faced with what once would have seemed an unthinkable scenario, having to kill and dispose of otherwise healthy livestock that can't get to market, they're also being hit with devastating financial losses. Farming losses translate into losses for all. Consumers in those states are staring at higher grocery bills and, in some cases, dwindling supplies on grocery store shelves. Meanwhile, meat processing plants have scrambled to meet CDC-issued guidance in an attempt to stem the COVID-19 tide hitting workers. Weeks after President Donald Trump deemed the meatpacking industry essential, allowing facilities to reopen, employers in the Midwest remain challenged in safely bringing back operations at full capacity. In a special report this week, reporters at Lee Enterprises newspaper and online media outlets take you inside the major industry that is meat production and processing in the Midwest, retracing the cause and varied and real impacts of the COVID-19 crisis on everyone living within the greater region. From the meat ranches and farms to the grocery store shelves and consumer wallets, here is how the COVID-19 impact on Midwest meat processing facilities is impacting nearly everyone. As COVID-19 has sickened the workforce of various major meat production plants, grinding the industry to a crawl or halt, a different, less clinical sickness is setting in with the farmers who feed the nation's meat supply chain. For Mike Paustian, whose 1,400-acre Paustian Enterprises farm in Walcott sees about 600 pigs born weekly, it's a sickness of the stomach regarding what he and other livestock producers might have to do to respond to the crisis. As of May 2nd, the U.S. had lost nearly 45% of its pork processing capacity over 2 months, about 38% of its cattle processing, according to the Iowa Farm Bureau Federation. Pork processing facilities in Iowa, on average, can handle about 150,000 hogs per day. The impact of COVID-19 on meat processing plants has reduced that to 40,000 or 50,000 per day in recent weeks, said Mike Negg, secretary for the Iowa Department of Agriculture. That reality has led to a sea of livestock on farms and ranches that has nowhere to go. It's going to take months to get through this backlog, and that's where it's going to come down to each individual farm on how much wiggle room they can find and how long they can hold off having to do something drastic, such as euthanizing pigs, Paustian said. All producers are trying to delay until the last possible minute of the last possible hour of the last possible day, because that just makes you sick to your stomach to have to think about doing that. The whole goal is to get that pig into the food supply, and for that not to happen is heartbreaking. Midwestern agricultural officials aren't reporting widespread euthanizing of livestock yet, but the possibility looms. Meanwhile, many working to feed the food supply chain are witnessing the entire industry on the butcher's block. Fred Linz owns Meat by Linz, a Calumet City, Illinois-based supplier to many of the nation's finest white tablecloth steakhouses. Just across the South Suburban Chicago border, Linz also runs the Linz Heritage Angus Cattle Farm in Crown Point, Indiana. He's watching a COVID-19 cleaver cut 40% to 60% of the capacity at meat harvesting facilities. Labor is not showing up to the harvesting facilities for a few reasons. They have COVID-19, they're scared to get COVID-19, or they're collecting $600 a week in unemployment, Linz said. Meat processing plants that used to run 650,000 heads of cattle a week nationwide are down to 450,000 a week, he added. Retailers are seeing all-time high prices, but pork cattle producers are seeing the lowest prices on live cattle since 2008, Linz said. Without the vital connection of processing plants at full capacity, meat suppliers aren't making any money, and their customers, grocers, restaurants, and consumers, are paying a lot more. the epicenter of the well-documented COVID-19's impact on the Midwest meat supply chain are the large processing plants, at which social distancing is difficult and the disease has inflicted numerous workers and led to plant shutdowns. With cramped conditions, the CDC said meatpacking plants are inherently more susceptible to the spread of COVID-19, with shoulder-to-shoulder workspaces, fast-paced production lines, and difficulty adhering to strict disinfectant guidelines. At the heart of this corner of the epidemic are the processing workers, whose importance to the nation's food supply chain put them in harm's way to begin with. "My five-year-old wants me to hug him, and I can't," said Raquel Sanchez Alvarado, a worker at the American Foods Group's plant near Green Bay, Wisconsin. Alvarado survived COVID-19 and is quick to note, "It was not my choice to get sick. We heard people were sick, but we weren't informed," another American Foods Group's worker, Filiberto Reyes Martinez, said during a press conference last month as he described conditions on the work floor during the pandemic. "The line was moving so fast. We were sweating heavily. Our masks were slipping and wouldn't stick to our faces." In Wisconsin alone, more than 600 workers in meat plants have contracted COVID-19, according to industry estimates. But the number could be much higher under the haze of incomplete reporting. Green Bay-based JBS Packerland plant is the site of Wisconsin's worst known outbreak, with 255 confirmed cases as of April 28th, according to CDC records. JBS spokeswoman Nikki Richardson noted in an email, "What I can share is we are doing everything we can to provide a safe working environment for our team members who are producing food for the country during these unprecedented times." As of May 1st, 115 meat and poultry processing facilities had reported COVID-19 cases across 19 states, according to the CDC. Among the 130,000 workers at the facilities, more than 4,900 cases and 20 deaths have been reported. The Midwestern states of Illinois, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Ohio submitted data to the CDC. Indiana, Minnesota, and Michigan did not. Nearly 380, or 18.2% of workers, at Iowa's two meatpacking plants tested positive for the disease in late April, according to CDC figures. For comparison, about 112, or 1.7%, of workers in Illinois' five plants tested positive last month. Seven major meat packing plants in Illinois have reported coronavirus cases, with one reported employee death with Smithfield Foods in St. Charles, Illinois, and two employee deaths with Tyson Fresh Meats 1, Jocelyn, in Hillsdale, Illinois. Rantoul Foods in Rantoul, Illinois, partially shut down its facility on Monday for sanitation after 83 employees tested positive for the virus. More than 200 employees were tested May 8th and 9th through an on-site testing facility at the packing plant. "It ain't pretty making sausage," said Dr. David Fletcher of SafeWorks Illinois, an occupational health services organization overseeing the testing. "It's highly repetitive in close quarters, an animal after it's killed going down a line, cutting the hog up and getting the pieces of meat. It's an industry assembled around efficiency, scale, and a complex network of transportation and distribution systems. A change in one area can trigger a series of issues up and down the chain states away." In Minnesota, the JBS meatpacking plant, one of the state's largest pork processing plants, shuttered April 20th at a time when only a handful of its workers tested positive for COVID-19. It's since reopened in a limited capacity earlier this month, despite 622 of its workers recently testing positive for the disease. The JBS plant is by far the city of Worthington's biggest employers, with about 2,200 workers. Some live in the small city. Others commute an hour's drive every day for work, Worthington City Administrator Steve Robinson said. In conversations with JBS's general manager this week, Robinson said he learned the plant was still short about 500 employees, preventing them from returning to full capacity. JBS typically produces about 20,000 hogs a day, but daily production is down to about 14,000, he said. Overall, 944 meatpacking plant employees have tested positive at eight different Minnesota plants, according to the Minnesota Department of Health. In Indiana, about 900 employees, or 40% of the workforce, at the Tyson Foods plant in Logansport tested positive for coronavirus, leading to an April 25th closure. That was right before the Tyson Foods chairman warned the U.S. food supply chain is breaking in a full-page ad in the New York Times. The challenges facing the meat processing facilities have meant some jigs and jags by livestock producers trying to weather the COVID-19 storm. Driving down the road to Macon County, Illinois, with a truck full of pigs, Thomas Titus considers himself lucky. "We're in survival mode," he said of his Central Illinois hog farming operation. "Every time we're able to put a pig on a truck, it's a great feeling." A farmer in Elkhart, Illinois, Titus was heading to a small, family-owned meat processor last week after selling his first truck of pigs in more than 3 weeks. His farm, Tri-Pork Inc., was forced to develop partnerships with small-scale meat processing facilities since the COVID-19 outbreak forced several major slaughterhouses to close across the Midwest and nation. Still, some cattle producers are getting hit by the COVID-19 onslaught on multiple fronts. Not only is their market drying up, but they are experiencing a shortage of affordable feed. "For fat cattle and feeder calves, the market has gone south," said Teresa Steckler, a University of Illinois beef educator. "Then you have the issue with commodities becoming hard to come by as well, because not as much ethanol is being produced. A byproduct of ethanol production is dried distiller's grains, which are a low-cost source of high-protein food for livestock. In an attempt to adjust, some farmers are changing the way they market their goods, selling directly to retail establishments and consumers instead of through the normal supply chain," Steckler said. Steckler noted an independent hog producer in southern Illinois was able to sell all but 10 of his 250 fat hogs locally. "There is a lot more direct sales," she said. "There has been quite a bit of cattle going through some of the local meat processors." In Davenport, Bam Bam, a 2,000-pound bull, gulped down an apple fed to it by Dale Shearer on a recent windy day. Bam Bam is among the 80 head of cattle on Shearer's 58 acres of land in the Quad Cities. Shearer said he so far weathered the industry storm because of a pivot he made years ago. A meat processing facility where he formerly processed his cows was purchased by a corporation, and he shifted gears, ultimately beginning to use farmers markets instead of relying on contracts with large meat operators. Sales were up 60% compared to this week a year ago for Shearer Custom Meats as a result, Shearer said. But uncertainty lingers for the greater industry. "There are so many unknown and uncontrollable things right now," said Leon Adams, who farms near Bonney in southern Illinois' Jefferson County. "All you can do is stick to your plan, put your crop in, and hope this thing levels itself out by midsummer." Clear Lake's Thursdays on Main launches summer series online. One of Clear Lake's most popular summer events will kick off virtually this year. The Clear Lake Area Chamber of Commerce announced on Facebook earlier this week that Thursdays on Main will be streamed online in May and June due to current COVID-19 restrictions on social gatherings, including parades, festivals, conventions, and fundraisers across Iowa. "No one wants to have physical events more than we do," said Stacy Dugan, Clear Lake Chamber President and CEO. "We want to be together on Main, but for health and safety of community, first responders, and medical professionals, we must adhere to guidance put forth by the state at this time." Thursdays on Main is a summer event series that features live entertainment, food and retail vendors, activities, movies, and more on Thursday evenings from June through August in downtown Clear Lake. The online event, which was revealed in a video posted Wednesday, will be called Thursdays Online and will be done in partnership with Zion and Powerhouse Theater. Facebook Live events are scheduled for 7 p.m. Thursday, May 21st, and Thursday, June 18th, and they will feature entertainment from local musicians. Dugan said in-person Thursdays on Main events will not take place before then. "We're still trying to figure out unique ways to adjust to all the restrictions, but for now, instead of doing nothing, we've put together Thursdays Online," she said. Thursday's event will be a tribute to the class of 2020 and include entertainment from Clear Lake High School seniors and messages from their teachers and members of the community. The Mockingbirds will perform a 45-minute set after the tribute. The Mockingbirds, comprising Rich and Tina Mock and Nate Benzing of Clear Lake, play rock and roll music from the 50s to 90s, rockabilly, classic country, and blues throughout the state. The June event will feature the musical talents of Betty and the Gents, a four-person band from Mason City involving Betsy and Tom Kirby, Marty Garrett, and Brett Schoeneman. This is one way of providing some entertainment and positivity to living rooms without getting together, Dugan said. We want this to be an encouraging event that people can watch from home. She said the chamber is also working with their Thursdays on Main vendors to create a virtual shopping market for those missing their favorite food, goods, and services that will be promoted during the live events. The live events will be available on the Thursdays on Main and Clear Lake Chamber of Commerce Facebook pages, as well as broadcast locally through CL Vision. For more information about the status of Clear Lake's upcoming events, visit clearlakeiowa.com or follow the Thursdays on Main or Clear Lake Area Chamber of Commerce Facebook pages. Clear Lake School Board approves greenhouse bid. The Clear Lake Community School District is moving forward with another project included in the multi-million-dollar bond referendum residents passed in March. The Clear Lake School Board unanimously approved four quotes totaling nearly $109,000 for the district's new greenhouse Tuesday evening during its meeting. The project was estimated to cost between $75,000 and $80,000. It is going to cost more than what I had budgeted, but when Tony and I looked at this, we didn't realize that the electrical and plumbing and the gas was going to be quite as much as it was, Superintendent Doug G. said. The school board approved the $55,726 quote from Atlas Greenhouse of Alapaha, Georgia, to construct a 30-foot by 48-foot galvanized steel-framed greenhouse, including irrigation mist, fertilizer injector, and controller features. The quote was one of two the district received. The other was from Rymel Greenhouse Systems, LLC of Hooksett, New Hampshire, for $47,671, but didn't include as many features as the one from Atlas. The school board also approved the concrete bid from Concrete Complete of Clear Lake for $25,357, the electrical bid from Linehan Electric, Inc. of Mason City for $15,800, and the plumbing bid from Secory Plumbing and Heating, Inc. of Clear Lake for $11,777. Well, I think with the support of the ag program that we've seen, if it's what it costs, it's what it costs, said Tony Brownlee, a school board member. The greenhouse is among three projects the district is moving forward with this summer from the bond referendum. The others include security upgrades at Clear Creek Elementary and improvements at Lions Field Athletic Complex. The Clear Lake Community School District's $18 million bond referendum was approved 1,012 to 464 during a special election on March 3rd. The vote gives the school district the authority to issue debt for construction and improvement projects at its elementary school, middle school, and high school facilities. Some of the projects included in the referendum are security upgrades at Clear Creek Elementary, estimated to cost between $350,000 and $450,000, improvements at Lions Field Complex, estimated between $3 million and $4 million, and a wellness center, estimated to cost about $10 million. Dean Snyder Construction of Clear Lake was awarded the contracts for the Clear Creek Elementary Secure Entrance Project for $515,230 in March and for the Lions Field Athletic Complex Improvements Project for $2,443,900 in April. Both projects were scheduled to begin in mid to late May after the school year and the spring sports season ended, but G said work started a month ahead of schedule on the Lions Field Athletic Complex and about 3 weeks early at Clear Creek Elementary. The elementary, Lions Field, and greenhouse projects are scheduled to be done before the 2020-21 school year. G said although the greenhouse bid came in over the estimate, it should not affect the remaining projects, especially since Lions Field came in quite a bit under budget. I am keeping track of all of the expenses to make sure we stay within our budget, he said. The big one, the Health, Wellness, and Recreation Center project, which is being done in collaboration with the City of Clear Lake, is expected to go out for bid in late summer or early fall, so it can be completed by the fall of 2021. A salute to the class of 2020. Clear Lake recognizes seniors with community parade. The Clear Lake High School's class of 2020 received a community send-off into the next chapter of their lives Friday evening. The class's nearly 100 seniors participated in a 16-mile parade escorted by the Clear Lake Police Department throughout the city and around the lake. Friday marked the last day of school for Clear Lake students. The parade was organized by teachers and parents as a surprise to recognize the high school seniors' accomplishments amid the COVID-19 pandemic. The high school graduation ceremony, originally scheduled for Sunday, has been postponed until June 21st. West Hancock freshman, one of 17, chosen for summer music program. A West Hancock high school freshman is one of 17 people nationwide attending a summer program at one of the most prestigious music schools in the country. Isabel Rosen, 15, who has been playing the French horn for the past 5 years, was accepted to participate in an online workshop by the Eastman School of Music in August to help improve her horn playing. "I think I'll just go and take in as much as I can and learn as much as I can, and I'm really excited for how it's going to further my musical career," she said. The program, Fun of Fundamentals, A Path to Enhanced Artistry on the Horn, is taught by Peter Corral, one of the most well-known con 8D French horn players in the world and a part of the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra, along with Nicolette Labonte, who plays in the Fort Worth Symphony Orchestra and the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra, and Elizabeth Frymuth, who is a member of the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra and a professor at Brevard Music Center. "It's just kind of crazy that I'm going to be able to be studying with some of the top horn professors in the nation," Isabel said. Isabel started playing the con 8D French horn when she was in fifth grade and said she likes playing it because it's a way to express herself. "Whether you're mad or happy or anything, it's a place you can go and just express that," she said. Her mother, Jennifer Rosen, who is also the band teacher for West Hancock Middle and High Schools, said ever since she picked up the French horn, Isabel has wanted to be a professional horn player. "I kind of have a unique position as both mom and teacher because I get to see her in different settings, and at home she lives with her French horn," Jennifer said. "I mean, she is playing 2 to 4 hours a day right now and loves every moment of it. If she has a spare second, she is playing her horn." Though there aren't any orchestras around here, Isabel has always been working to play her horn better, whether that's through watching videos or taking private lessons with her tutor, Wayne Liu. "Because we're in such a small area and there are limited opportunities around here for playing like orchestras," Jennifer said. "We don't have a lot of orchestras around here, so for her to get that kind of exposure is kind of unheard of, and to think that she's going to be playing with the best horn players in the world is really, really cool." Liu encouraged Isabel to apply for the summer music program at Eastman because she wants to play the French horn professionally as an orchestral musician, and this program is a good opportunity for her to improve. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the program had to be moved to an online seminar, and the number of participants was limited to 17 people, who could range from high schoolers to adults throughout the country. Applications were due by May 15th, and applicants needed to include a music resume that included any accomplishments, such as honor bands, all-state and recitals, along with music literature they'd played, and an audition video that included an etude out of Koppers Studies for Low Horn. Isabel sent her application April 16th, and within a few days she had already heard back that she was accepted, Jennifer said. "There were some squeals of delight as she ran up the stairs with her letter in her hand," she said. "Now that she's accepted, she'll be learning how to extend and control her range, shape her sound, and use it to her advantage through 3 half-hour lessons with each of the 3 professors and some online seminars between April 3rd and 5th. Though there's no preparation required for the program, Isabel said she's preparing a solo, an adaptation of the Bach cello suites for horn, to play for her lessons. After the summer program, Isabel will audition for the National Youth Orchestras of America through Carnegie Hall, which has a more intense and lengthy audition process than the one for the summer program. On June 1st, the audition excerpts for the 2021 program will be posted, and applications officially open September 10th, with an application deadline of November 12th and a recommendation deadline of December 1st. Jennifer said Isabel is unique in that she never settles for okay. She wants to be the best and will do whatever it takes, whether practicing for extra hours, doing extra studying, or reading articles. "I'm just really proud of all the accomplishments that she has made in this amount of time," she said. "She's only played for about 5 years, so that's really cool, and I love to see the goals that she has set for herself." California Rescue flying 1,000 Iowa hens back to sanctuary. A California farm animal sanctuary is spending thousands of dollars to send two cargo planes to Iowa to rescue 1,000 chickens that were going to be euthanized at a struggling egg farm. Workers affiliated with the sanctuary animal place loaded chickens onto the plane Saturday morning at the Fort Dodge Airport. The group planned to fly the hens in more than 60 crates to California, where they will be taken to the group's sanctuary near Grass Valley, about 50 miles northeast of Sacramento. The organization's director, Kim Sterla, said Friday the hens came from a nearby egg farm that is going out of business. The farm planned to kill the chickens, but agreed instead to give them to the California Rescue, which will rehabilitate the hens and adopt them out to people throughout California. Sterla declined to name the egg operation. The rehabilitation process takes about 2 weeks to a month, Sterla said. These are birds that have lived their whole lives in a cage. They've never felt earth on their feet. Sterla said she doesn't know the cost of the effort, but as estimated it's in the tens of thousands of dollars. Much of that is raised through fundraising and in-kind donations. For example, the planes were donated by their own owner, Sterla said. Iowa rebuilds PPE stockpile after deals with unusual sources. Iowa has rebuilt its stockpile of personal protective equipment after a dire shortage that prompted the state to buy through unusual sources, including $7 million in contracts for gowns and goggles with a business known for making Republican campaign signs. Iowa's executive branch signed $45 million worth of emergency purchase orders for isolation gowns, masks, face shields, goggles, and other equipment from mid-March through April, documents obtained by the Associated Press show. The deals include 590,000 masks that were purchased directly from China and several with businesses that have never before supplied such materials. In three contracts worth $7.2 million, the state agreed to purchase 1 million isolation gowns and 100,000 clear plastic goggles through Competitive Edge, Inc., a Des Moines business that has never sold either. The company supplies promotional items like T-shirts and has long been a go-to vendor for Republican campaigns buying yard and barn signs. Owner David Greenspan, a former Republican appointee on the Iowa Finance Authority Board, said state agencies reached out unsolicited, asking for help securing supplies from China because he has long imported from there. Now, Greenspan said he's overseeing manufacturing in three Chinese factories, and the items will be delivered to Iowa over the next month. We were lucky enough to get some business. I am happy about that. I like to be busy, he said. It's been a tough few months, but we didn't close through any of it. Maybe that was fortuitous. When somebody from the state called, we were here. Greenspan is charging the state $6.96 per gown and $2.59 for each pair of goggles. He said neither item will be medical grade. The contracts didn't have to go through the mandatory open bidding process. Governor Kim Reynolds suspended those requirements for all goods and services needed to fight the coronavirus in a March 9th emergency proclamation. The governor said Friday the state has started to receive orders that were placed in March, allowing its inventory to be rebuilt. Our stockpile is in a good place right now, Reynolds said. Executive branch spokeswoman Tammy Wenchek said Iowa has ordered 33.6 million items since February and received more than half of them. She said orders for 1 million other items were canceled after the vendor could not fulfill them on the state's timeline. A spreadsheet obtained by the AP shows Iowa's inventory includes 8.8 million surgical masks, 664,000 face shields, 356,000 respirators, 1.3 million gloves, and 67,000 isolation gowns, but a shortage of goggles still exists. These figures do not include millions of additional items the Iowa National Guard has delivered to all 99 counties. The situation has improved since the pandemic arrived in Iowa 2 months ago amid a national shortage of supplies, alarming healthcare officials. On March 22nd, a top Iowa Department of Public Health official emailed University of Iowa experts asking whether used protective equipment could be disinfected by UV light or chemicals and reworn. Ken Sharp, Iowa's Director of Acute Disease Prevention, Emergency Response, and Environmental Health, also asked them to brainstorm what off-the-wall solutions may be viable if traditional equipment was unavailable. I realize these sound like desperate questions, but we are planning in unusual times and need to give consideration to all potential options, Sharp wrote in the email obtained by the AP. On April 10th, his department declared a shortage of personal protective equipment and directed healthcare providers to use face masks for treating multiple patients, use washable gowns, and shorten hospital stays to preserve respirators. Supplies that were beyond their expiration dates could also be used. That order remains in effect. Some healthcare workers report having trouble finding adequate supplies despite the replenished state stockpile. It's unclear whether taxpayers are getting good value for their money. Contracts show the state has paid vastly different prices for similar products. In March, the state purchased 400 8-ounce bottles of hand sanitizer from an out-of-state vendor for $4.69 apiece. Then in April, the state signed a contract with an Iowa company to produce hand sanitizer for a fraction of that cost, $10 apiece per 128-ounce bottles. The state has paid between $4.64 and $19.35 for each isolation gown. Goggles have ranged from $1.12 apiece to $2.85, and disposable face shields have varied from $1.25 apiece to $3. The state purchased 590,000 face shields directly from a Chinese exporter for $938,000, or $1.59 per shield. That shipment was to be flown from China to an Ankeny food warehouse, a March 27th purchasing order shows. The state is buying 100,000 disposable face shields for $3 apiece from Honeycore Acquisition LLC, a Fairfield packing and distribution company that had never made them before. CEO Nate Wheaton said the $3 price was fair, saying similar items have been marketed for $5 or $7. We wanted a cost-competitive and cost-conscious product and to make sure we weren't gouging, he said. We think that's where we ended up. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Saturday, May 16th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Robert H. Baker, born October 19, 1951, died May 13, 2020. Robert Bob Henry Baker, 68, passed away on May 13th at his home in Minnetonka, Minnesota. Due to the COVID-19 situation, no services will be held at this time. Those who wish may send a memorial in Bob's name to the Pleasant Valley Golf Course, 405 First Street North, Thornton, Iowa, or the Minnesota Arboretum in Chaska, Minnesota. Robert Henry Baker was born on October 19, 1951, in Hampton to Russell and Jean Baker. He grew up on the family farm south of Thornton with his sisters Mary Ann and Barbara and brother Roger. He graduated from Meservey Thornton High School in 1970, lettering in multiple sports including golf, baseball, basketball, and football. He continued his academic and football career at Luther College in Decorah, where he met his future wife, Joy Tesmer. After college, he moved to Des Moines and worked for the Chicago Northwestern Railroad as a conductor brakeman, marrying Joy on June 21, 1975. In 1978, he decided to follow in his father Russ's footsteps, moving to Sheffield to join the family business as a farmer. He also enjoyed doing the greenskeeping work at the Pleasant Valley Golf Course in Thornton. While he and Joy lived in Sheffield, they added two children to the family, Kimberly in 1978 and Adam in 1980. In 1988, Joy took a job in Forest City and the family moved there, turning Bob into a commuter farmer for the next 11 years, driving 45 to 60 miles each way to complete his farming operation. While there, he also worked at Winnebago Motorhomes, Totem Foods, and in carpentry. In 1992, again following Joy's career, the family made another move to Waverly to complete their children's education, staying until 1999 when the kids had moved to college in Decorah and Iowa City. During this time, Bob continued to farm from a remote position and in the off-season filled his extra times with jobs at a local construction firm, in maintenance at CUNA Mutual, and as a butcher at the Janesville Locker. With the kids effectively off to college, Bob and Joy returned to their roots in Thornton in 1999. In 2004, he was diagnosed with tonsil cancer, and for the next 16 years, he fought with collectively more and more difficult health issues related to the cancer and the treatment's side effects. He retired from farming in 2013, after which he spent his time golfing, assisting with maintenance at the Thornton Golf Course, gardening, and traveling, completing his tour of all 50 states. One of his favorite activities throughout his life was playing pinochle with friends and family, and he won his final game, defeating his wife and daughter-in-law this past weekend. In 2016, they moved to Minnetonka, Minnesota to be near family, with both children having relocated to the area after their college careers. He loved having his family drop by to visit, and the grandchildren always caused extra smiles. His favorite place to visit was the Rose Garden at the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum. He is survived by his wife, Joy, his children, Kimberly Harima and spouse David of Minnetonka, Minnesota, Adam and spouse Bonnie of Minneapolis, Minnesota, his grandchildren, Christopher Baker, Olivia Harima, and Gavin Harima, his sister, Barbara Logan of Arden Hills, Minnesota, his brother, Roger Baker, and spouse, Sandy of Sheffield, in-laws, James Tesmer of Rochester, Minnesota, Kathy Tesmer of Harmony, Minnesota, Jean Tesmer and spouse Diane of Knob Noster, Missouri, and many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, Russell and Jean Baker, his sister, Mary Ann Baker, and brother-in-law, Gerald Tesmer. Sandra K. Kuhlemeyer, born September 27, 1944, died May 14, 2020. Sandra Sandy K. Kuhlemeyer, 75, of 1475 210th Street, Rockford, died Thursday morning, May 14th, at Mercy One Hospice in Mason City. Private family graveside services will be held at a later date in Riverside Cemetery, Rockford. Sandra K. Kuhlemeyer was born on September 27, 1944, in Charles City, the daughter of Ralph and Roseanne Niece McDowell. She graduated from Rudd Rockford Marble Rock School System with the class of 1962. She then graduated from LeJames College of Beauty in Mason City. For many years, she owned and operated Sandy's Stylette in Rudd. After having her children, she was employed at Bylow in Rockford for 20-plus years. Sandy was a mainstay in the kitchen at Zion Lutheran Church, where she was a faithful member, serving and organizing food for funerals and other events. She would drop anything she was doing to help others in need. Those that knew her well were aware that she loved to tend her garden, raise her chickens, keep a clean home, and be out mowing the lawn. She also liked to read romance novels, cook, and dance with her husband at the Surf Ballroom and the Moose Lodge in Charles City. She enjoyed going for drives, attending all the grandkids' ball games, taking the occasional trips to Branson, and playing some games of chance. Sandra was joined in marriage to her high school sweetheart, Courtney Cork Kuhlemeyer, on December 5, 1964, at Zion Lutheran Church, Rockford. Those surviving Sandy include her husband, Courtney, of 55 years, her son, Brett, and his wife, Deborah Kuhlemeyer of Rudd, her mother, Roseanne Miller of Rudd, five grandchildren, Connor and his wife, Olivia, Colin, Clayton, Cooper, and Camden Kuhlemeyer, her sister, Kathy Fortney, and spouse Chuck of Fort Dodge, two brothers, Jim McDowell and spouse Claudia of Bullhead City, Arizona, and Jerry McDowell and spouse Kim of Mason City. Preceding her in death are her two children, Justin Arthur and Darcy Lynn Kuhlemeyer, her father, Ralph McDowell, and sister, Connie Rewerts. Arrangements are with Fullerton Schumberg Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Rockford, Iowa. Michael Lynn Wold. Michael Lynn Wold, 61, of St. Ansgar, died Wednesday, May 13th, at his home. A private family funeral will take place at a later date. A public visitation will be held on Sunday, May 17th, from noon to 5 p.m. Due to the COVID-19 virus, it will be 10 people in and then 10 people out, with cleanings on touched surfaces between each group. Burial will take place at First Lutheran Cemetery in St. Ansgar. In lieu of flowers, please direct memorials to the St. Ansgar Fire Department. Holly Neuberger joins Avenue of the Saints Animal Hospital. Holly Neuberger has joined Avenue of the Saints Animal Hospital, which serves Charles City, Waverly, and the surrounding areas. Neuberger started at Avenue of the Saints Animal Hospital in January 2020. Neuberger grew up in Clear Lake, where she still resides. She earned her biology degree at the University of Northern Iowa in 2014 and her doctorate in veterinary medicine at Iowa State University College of Veterinary Medicine, graduating in 2018. She has also recently received abdominal ultrasound training at Sound Academy of Veterinary Imaging in Arlington, Texas. First Security's Cindy Olerking retiring after 20 years. Cindy Olerking, Trust Administrative Assistant, retired on May 14th after a 20-year career with First Security. Olerking joined the bank as Trust Secretary in April 2000 after moving to Charles City in January of that year. She has worked with that department for the last 20 years. Cindy has provided excellent service to our clients, commented Julie Versluis, Vice President, Trust Officer. She has enriched the lives of those she served over the last 20 years. Olerking's husband, Patrick, recently retired as store director with Hy-Vee. The Olerkings are looking forward to eventually spending more time together following Cindy's retirement. Laura Mills has been hired to replace Olerking at First Security. Mills relocated to Charles City from Cedar Falls and joined First Security as Trust Administrative Specialist in February with 18 years of experience in banking, primarily assisting in the trust and wealth management areas. Laura has an excellent skill set. She excels at problem solving and project management, said Versluis. Her high regard for details and accuracy is essential to our business and client relationships. We enjoy having her as part of the team. Century 21 received Productivity Service Awards. Century 21 Real Estate LLC awarded its local office Century 21 Preferred with the Quality Service Pinnacle Award. The annual award is based on results from the Century 21 Quality Service Survey, which is emailed to consumers immediately after the purchase or sale of a home. To earn the Century 21 Quality Service Pinnacle Award, an office must receive completed customer surveys with an average survey score of at least 95% or better for two consecutive years. The office also received the Per Person Productivity Award and the President's Award. The President's Award is bestowed upon those offices that earn the Century 21 Centurion Award and the Century 21 Quality Service Pinnacle Award in the same calendar year. The Centurion Award is presented to offices that achieve or surpass sales production of 465 closed transactions within a calendar year. Century 21 Preferred is located in Mason City with a branch office in Clear Lake and Northwood. Virus complicates driver education courses. Before Stacy Herman slides behind the wheel to begin her driving exam, she must first pull her mask over her face, yank her gloves over her hands, and make sure she has signed a waiver verifying that she does not have a fever. Finally, after she has completed every step of the protocol, she can drive. Recently, students from Clayton Ridge High School in Gutenberg and Central High School in Elkader finished up on the online portion and started moving to the driving portion of their 30-hour driver's education course through Northeast Iowa Community College. In pre-pandemic days, the students would have had their parents drop them off at school for in-person instruction to complete the first portion of the course. But instead, the teens were able to hop on the class by opening up their laptops, putting on their headphones, and connecting to the Zoom video call. Although it was driving instructor John Hess's first time teaching the course through Zoom, he made it work. They watched the video and they will go over some notes and can work in groups, he told the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. They are at home in their bedroom or living room for the class, but they can grab their phone and chat with their partner for the test. Hess said he delivered driving books to all of his students, and during the Zoom class, he reviews each chapter with his students. It's basically like in a classroom, he said. A lot of kids are comfortable being at home taking the class. Hess said students in Dubuque County also take the class through NICC. He said he planned to teach it in Dubuque later this summer, but already is preparing for it to be all online as well. But right now, students in Dubuque are not able to drive with instructors like Hess due to the social distancing restrictions that Dubuque County and 21 other counties remain under. And until they can drive with an instructor, students will not be able to receive their driver's permits or licenses, he said. They do their classroom online, but they have to drive 6 hours with an instructor, Hess said. Right now, they wouldn't be able to drive with me in Dubuque. Darcy Doty, Director for Driver and Identification Services at the Iowa Department of Transportation, said students who already completed driver's education and their 6 hours with an instructor can go to the DOT website to fill out an application to receive a paper license through the mail. For students that are turning 16, if they have a permit, they can request to have their license processed remotely, she said. We review that and call the family and make sure they have approved it. Although a few glitches popped up during the Zoom driver's ed class, overall, everything went smoothly, Herman said. I liked it very much because I was going to be on a very tight schedule to get to Gutenberg with extracurricular activities, she said. I think it is very beneficial to people that may struggle in new areas, and they didn't feel like somebody was watching them the whole time. Herman said she is a little bit nervous about the driving portion of the class, but as long as she follows all the safety measures, she thinks it will be all right. I think it's going to be more of a challenge with this whole COVID-19 thing, but as long as we wear the masks and gloves, I don't think it will be too much of a challenge, she said. Like Herman, Brooke Hansel said she was happy that the class was moved online. She lives about 20 minutes away from the campus and said the daily trek would have grown tedious for her parents. I have never taken an online class, but I have already planned to take many of my college classes online, Hansel said. I got to see some of my friends on Zoom and talk to them about that. At West Delaware Community School District, Superintendent Kristen Rickey said students also will sign up to complete a portion of their driving course virtually. Our normal driver's ed teacher will provide instruction as he always does, with the same content and standards, but in a virtual setting, she said in an email. Cedar Falls couple takes road trip without leaving town. George and Sandy Glenn have lived in Cedar Falls since 1966. Like most residents, they've driven many of the city streets over the years, but not every street. While sheltering at home during the COVID-19 pandemic, an old conversation popped up, one the couple have had many times. Over the years, we'd be driving and go past a street and wonder, what's down there? Or, we've never been down that street before. We decided to drive those streets, said Sandy, a former member of the Cedar Falls City Council. They hatched an idea for an adventure that would get them out of the house while following COVID-19 safety guidelines. They decided to call it their Great Cedar Falls Road Trip. George, a retired University of Northern Iowa professor of theater history, decided they needed a city map before setting off on the adventure. He found a free one in the Cedar Falls Visitor Center lobby, but the print was too small and it highlighted attractions, not city streets. At Sandy's behest, he called the city and paid $5 for a plat map. It's big and shows every street in Cedar Falls, including streets that haven't even been built yet, in areas under development, he told the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. We marked out in a green magic marker on the map every street we'd driven before, and then off we went. Sandy gave directions while I drove, George explained. Between April 6th and 17th, the Glens made 8 afternoon drives for a total of 226 miles, and they never left the city limits. As they navigated each street, Sandy marked it in yellow on the map. Their last drive was a 150-yard-long street off Green Hill Road that is under development. I was on the way to the Cann Redemption Center on Green Hill, and there's a construction project. I'd never paid much attention before, but this time I saw a street sign. I went home and got Sandy, and we went back and drove down the street and amended our record, George said. Their journeys took them through residential and commercial areas and neighborhoods, large and small, in all socioeconomic levels. Their longest drive was 51 miles from their home to explore northeast Cedar Falls, as far as we could go and stay in the city limits, he explained. 80% of the new streets we drove weren't here when we moved to town in 66. Sandy was surprised at the number of cul-de-sacs and dead-end streets, but she was delighted to see so many people outdoors in their yards, working in the yard, washing cars, cleaning garages, playing with their dogs. There were kids riding bikes. Neighbors were social distancing, but people waved at us. Sometimes we wondered if people noticed how we were driving up one street and down the next and thought about calling the cops, she said, laughing. Although they never got out of their car, the Glens found their Great Cedar Falls road trip comforting. For Sandy, it brought back memories of leisurely Sunday afternoon drives and driving around to ooh and ah over Christmas lights during the holidays. Glenn recalled the days of lower gas prices, and he felt lucky to use his gas discount card at a convenience store and fill up his tank for 78 cents a gallon. The Glenn's road trip has encouraged their friends to explore their own backyards. Just wave when you go by, George added. In full swing, North Iowa golf participation above average despite COVID-19 fears. North Iowa golf courses have seen more golfers at the opening of this season than they have in previous years. Some courses, those numbers may not tell the whole story. With the spread of COVID-19 and ongoing concern, some experienced golfers are apprehensive about hitting the links, while younger golfers are coming out in droves. Brian Pauley, the Mason City Superintendent of Recreation and Golf, says the two trends are offsetting each other for a positive gain in greens fees and some passes for the Highland Park Golf Course in Mason City. "We haven't seen people out yet that I've seen the last 8 summers," he said. "We are seeing some of the people that need something to do that have never been to Highland, but now they are coming out and golfing, so we're seeing both. I think there are people still hesitant to come." Before businesses and parks began to open up in the last few weeks, North Iowans had few choices to be outside and be active, which Mike Oyman, director of golf at Veterans Memorial Golf Course in Clear Lake, also attributes to the spike in younger golfers. "That's a positive with everything that's going on, is we can at least give everybody something to do," he said. The National Golf Foundation reports a 37.5% increase in rounds played in March, up from negative 26% in March of last year in the West North Central region, which includes Iowa, suggesting many Iowans were itching to get outside as the bulk of social distancing guidelines were in effect. Golf Advisor reports that, as of May 7th, all 50 states had lifted full bans on golf courses, with 18% of its U.S. partners surveyed still suspending play. Many states are permitting play as long as social distancing measures are kept in place, including Iowa, which continues its ban on social hubs. Until those restrictions, through Governor Kim Reynolds' emergency proclamation, are lifted, local courses are sticking to their sanitation practices and social distancing policies. "We have our guidelines posted on the door, and I've been pretty happy with everybody practicing it," Oyman said. "It's day-to-day, and everything changes daily, so you just have to be open with people being able to play golf." Toward the beginning of the season, uncertainty may have caused a dip in attendance for Highland Park, said Pauley. "Our early sales were horrible," he said. "People didn't know if we were closing or if we were opening or what that would look like." Pauley said his staff has been working to improve the experience at Highland. "We're constantly reviewing what we're doing with our sanitation efforts and making adjustments." Pauley said the confidence he has in his team's operation outweighs any concerns he may have about golfers who come from high-risk areas in the state or from other states. "We mitigate the risk as best as possible, and if we do that, it doesn't matter where the customer comes from," he said. "We felt that we put a good product out with modifications, and it was a safe environment for anyone to play. People are abiding by our social distance rules, so it's good to think that we can be busy, but also do it safely." Bob Jensen, guest columnist. Male walleyes like to eat after spawning. In much of walleye country, walleyes are moving from their spring hangouts to their summer locations. This movement usually lasts a couple of weeks. While they're moving away from their spawning areas and towards summering areas, the fish can be a little difficult to stay on. They will usually be in one spot today and somewhere else a day or two later. Keep in mind that male fish usually start biting a little sooner than the females after the spawn. The spawn is more exhausting for the females, so they take longer to recover from it. The males will eat a bit during the spawn and really eat right after the spawn. Males are usually smaller than females in the fish world, but that doesn't mean you won't catch any big fish. You might, but it's likely that your catch will consist mostly of smaller fish. Begin your search for walleyes near the areas where they spawned. Walleyes prefer to spawn on sand or rubble areas that taper gradually. Some current is preferred. After the spawn, they'll linger in the areas for a while before making a big move. Often they'll move to the nearest drop-off or emerging weed bed and hang around there for a few days, sometimes even longer. Walleyes can be caught by employing several lure presentations during this period. It works well to work fast until the fish are located, then slow down when you have them pinpointed. Walleyes will still be shallow, especially in stained water lakes. Casting will often be most productive, but if you prefer trawling or drifting, get your baits away from the boat to prevent spooking. This is even more important in clear water. I like to throw a crankbait when searching for walleyes in the shallows being less than 8 feet in depth. If there are a couple of anglers in the boat, they should start with different style crankbaits. When it comes to lure color, start with the natural color in clear water, a brighter color in stained water. However, don't get stuck on a particular color. Some walleyes will show a color preference. Keep experimenting until the fish show you what color and lure action they want on that day. When you find an area that has some fish, and when the aggressive biters have all been caught on the crankbait, work a jig-plastic combination through the area. The slower presentation will take some fish that wouldn't respond to the crankbait. An eighth or quarter ounce jig rigged with a rage swimmer in the smaller sizes is a good start. If they don't go for that, try a 16th or 8th ounce jig tipped with a minnow or leech and work it slower than you did the jig plastic combo. If and when the walleyes quit responding to that presentation, try a leech under a slip bobber. That setup will take the walleyes that aren't interested in chasing down faster moving baits. Or, better yet, go looking for a similar area and show your baits to fish that are more aggressive. After a few fish are caught from the area, the remaining fish can be tough to catch. Now and for the next couple of weeks, the walleyes will be moving from their spring areas to their summer areas. If you keep those movements in mind, you can be there waiting for their arrival. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Saturday, May 16th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.